Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:09 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 25th. Well, another very interesting day in markets, but I'd like to start off in Asia, where the Hang Seng and the H shares index were both down, and the H shares in particular breaking this progression of higher reaction lows that's been in evidence since the beginning of 2016. That's it within the context of a much wider, longer range that persisted or is persisting between 8 and 14,000. So the index, having broken the progression of higher reaction lows, now has an awful lot of work to do in order to demonstrate a return to demand dominance. But if the H shares in Hong Kong are deteriorating, they're certainly taking their lead from the deterioration that we're getting on the A share market in Shanghai. And that was down another 31 points today. This has been a significant deterioration since the beginning of this year. The market had been dribbling higher since the beginning of 2016 in what I described as a manufactured uptrend, that it was largely state-sponsored. And, well, this deterioration that we've seen since the beginning of this year suggests that the state-sponsored part of that rally is over. So there is certainly work to do in order to repair investor confidence. Well, when we think about what is it that is driving this, well, we saw that over the weekend the Chinese took another percent or so off their reserve requirement for the banks, but it does appear to be somewhat a little too late. And the market is now beginning to pick up pace on the downside. So, yes, there is acceleration on the downside in the short term. And we have seen spikes below the trend mean on previous occasions, but what is required in order to demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment is a very clear upward dynamic, similar to the kinds of conditions we've seen following other similar deteriorations. And in the absence of that, well, we give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. The Chinese economy is trying to transition away from this investment-led boom, and they are leaning on the shadow banking sector because of the danger that it holds for the economy. Now, on top of all of that, you have this concern about trade wars. Well, there are two things that China can do to combat the trade restrictions that the USA is attempting or threatening to impose. Well, the first is to allow the currency to devalue. They're certainly doing that. Then they're next step will be to initiate a nationalistic fervor type of response. So when for example, South Korea brought in the THAAD missile system, then the Chinese simply boycotted South Korean goods. Well, that's not particularly good news from the perspective of McDonald's or Starbucks or indeed Apple. And I think it is interesting that McDonald's in particular, having done so very well from all the way through 2017, is now back testing the region of its progression of higher reaction lows. And this chart has the appearance of a massive reaction against the prevailing uptrend and a period of right-hand extension. It's not the most bullish pattern in the world. And certainly if we were to see that it is breaking below the $155 area and sustaining that move, well, then we'd have to be talking about type 2 top formation completion. The USA is still Starbucks's primary market, but it also has a significant operation in China, and it has an evolving type 3 top formation. So these are the kinds of shares that are potentially going to be influenced by a boycott by Chinese consumers. But if there's any company that has got dependence on China, well, then Apple has got to be a big one. And the share, having surged to new all-time highs in the last few weeks, is now unwinding that short-term overbought condition. And when we look at the relative performance of stocks and what is going on? Well, one important point is that the renminbi's weakness should be put in context, because the dollar was not particularly firm in here today. In fact, it was it was falling against the vast majority of other currencies, with the exception of the Turkish lira and the Chinese renminbi. The dollar index, having sustained that move above the trend mean, now looks like it is going to at least consolidate, and that suggests that if currencies are still falling against the dollar in that manner, or in this particular condition, well, then there must be something really weak about them. So I think that's also worth highlighting with regard to the Chinese renminbi. Well, Erdogan won the Turkish election, and not by a small margin either. So that virtually ensures that he's going to be able to change the constitution in his favor. And following the initial rally, and I was rather puzzled as to why the currency and indeed the stock market had rallied, but they didn't rally for long, and the likelihood is now that the Turkish Central Bank is going to have to step in and try and arrest the decline of the currency once more. The volatility that we saw on the Turkish stock market is also really rather noteworthy, that we had a very brief rally right off the open, and then it gave up the entire advance. Again, this is not bullish action. So, what it suggests is that there is potential for additional downside. Then, when we look at what's going on in Europe, well, the Euro Stoxx index, having got all the way up towards 400, and that 400 level has represented an area of resistance since at least 2015. Well, with just a, I think, a whiff of strength in the euro, then the Euro Stoxx is pulling back, because the Eurozone has got a significant dependence on its export sector. There is no mistake in the fact that it is the EU and China are the greatest defenders of a global multilateral trading system, when they have been some of the primary beneficiaries of it. And I wonder if we have the same degree of support for globalization within the EU, if you were to strip out Germany, the Netherlands, and Austria, and if one were to look instead at much of France, or Spain, or Italy, or Greece, would we have the same support for globalization? What that also further highlights is that the rise of populism is as a direct response to to the loss of competitive forces for manufacturing within so many countries, and that it is where we've had the least effect on manufacturing is where you have the greatest support for globalization. That's not absolutely the case, but it is enough of the case to make the generalization. Then the Japanese yen was in mildly positive territory in here today, but it wasn't able to hold all of the rally. And part of the reason for that is because the Bank of Japan, and I've saved the I'm going to post this chart in comment of the day today, but the Bank of Japan, and it's has been inflating its balance sheet now for much of the last 5 years, and it has the pace of that expansion has slowed, but it has not reversed. Whereas if we were to look at China, then the People's Bank of China has pretty much stopped adding new money. There has been a considerable loss of momentum, and since the end of 2017, the quantity of money on its balance sheet has contracted. So that's also a rather interesting development, because the ECB is not far off stopping adding money to its balance sheet, whereas the Federal Reserve is already reducing the size of its balance sheet. So on aggregate, when we look at the total assets of central banks, they are declining in absolute terms, but because of the relative strength of the dollar, they are they're declining even more aggressively. So this is an important consideration, because I think this is not a condition that is I don't think a lot of people pay attention to this particular metric. that people do talk about the quantity of money that's outstanding, but I don't know of anyone else that's really spending a lot of time talking about the total amount of money that's flowing around the world. The reality is that capital is both global and mobile, and that it needn't necessarily be created in a country for it to stay there. That as long as there is an engine for a massive monetary accommodation somewhere in the world, then the global financial system takes care of the rest and shoves it around into the most productive assets. Well, the most productive asset so far in this cycle has been the Nasdaq 100, and it pushed all the way up to new highs just 3 days ago, and now it is pulling back, and it was off its lows in here today. But this 7,000 area represented the previous peak. It would be the very best of all possible worlds if the index were able to hold that 7,000 level on this pullback. We have a substantial number of shares that are really quite overextended relative to the trend mean, and the Supreme Court decision in the case against Wayfair is going to have a knock-on effect for online businesses, and that does represent an additional cost of compliance for companies like Amazon. But Amazon has got the resources to automate for it, whereas eBay is probably under a greater threat, and it was at a new reaction low in here today. And this is going to have to rally and do so in a hurry if we're going to move back into a demand-dominated environment. Well, I think that it is reasonable to conclude that when we look at the performance of stock markets generally, whether it is in China or the USA or Europe or the UK, that we've had a pretty impressive rally over the course of the last few months off the lows that we saw in February, and now we're getting some consolidation of that. And the consolidation will be deeper in some markets than others, and most particularly those that had benefited from a weakness in their currencies. If we see that the dollar rally is consolidating, well, then that will weigh on some of those inverse correlation type markets. Well, the relative weakness of the Aussie dollar was or is one of the contributing factors in the relative strength of the ASX 200. And the Aussie dollar was firmer on Friday and a little bit weaker in here today. But the more important point is that it has encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean, having really bounced from around that region over the course of the last 2 years. So while there is scope for some steadying, it would really have to stage a rather important rally to break the downward bias. So when we look at the ASX 200, then the index was in negative territory in here today, but not by an awful lot. And as long as it is holding the region of the trend mean, we can probably give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Well, when we look at the commodity complex, it has certainly been susceptible, or I think prone to volatility over the course of the last few weeks, and copper prices now are trading below the $3 level. Well, this is a big level for copper, and it has been down almost on consecutive days for the last 2 weeks, and it's now at the lower side of its range and in the region of the trend mean and below that psychological $3 area. So if it's going to bounce, then this is the area, and we are going to see whether it is capable of doing so this week. And if we get a clear downward break, well, then it could fall quite meaningfully from where it is right now, and that could potentially have a knock-on effect for the industrial metals generally. Then there, of course, will be people talking about a global slowdown because people regard copper as Dr. Copper, and that is or the very fact that it is used in every country in the world. But of course, China is by far the biggest consumer, and what's happening in China has a direct impact on what's happening in copper prices. The London Metal Exchanges Index is right back in the region of the trend mean, so it will really need to bounce from this area. Well, personally, I'm still long of nickel, and I do continue to think that it is going to benefit, but that is probably a medium-term consideration. There is a short-term overbought condition relative to the trend mean, and I'm starting to think that perhaps it might be discretion being the better part of valor if we're moving into a more corrective phase, particularly with China leading on the downside. Then I think it is also interesting what we saw in the bond markets in here today, because they were practically inert, and that tells us that we may be in a somewhat more corrective phase for stock markets, but that there is still a sea of additional demand, excuse me, of additional supply that is due to come through in the bond markets. And yields have been consolidating below 3% now since February, but they have been supported around the 2.8% level. This is a pretty narrow range. And if it's a narrow range on the 10-year treasury, it's an even narrower range on TIPS yields. I think the most important point about TIPS is that there is no new additional supply scheduled this year. So we can make the argument about the treasury market that there are these exogenous factors that are potentially going to upset the market. But that additional supply argument is not a factor in TIPS. And therefore, if yields sustain a move above 1%, then it's not because there's a big sea of additional supply. It's going to be because of another factor. So it's a much better gauge of the health of the bond markets generally. And this has been a range where the amplitude of trading has been contracting for nearly 2 years already, and it continues to find support in the region of the trend mean. And as long as it is doing that, then I think we can give the or I think the balance of probabilities is that when yields break, they're going to break on the upside. Then when we look at the oil market, well, it was resurgent on Friday, and it gave up some of that advance in here today, but certainly not in a dynamic manner. I think the most likely scenario is that if we were just simply to look at the technicals and strip away everything else, that the low that we've seen in oil prices over the course of the last 5 or 6 sessions is at least a short-term low, and that the most likely scenario is that it rallies from these levels. Then we've also seen that its WTI has exhibited relative strength, and it rallied much more powerfully on Friday. Well, the spread between the two contracts is contracting now, and so far it has held all of the breakout. Now, it was a little bit weaker in here today, but not by an awful lot, and that would suggest that as long as the low that is in the region of about $64, as long as that holds, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to higher to lateral ranging. Now, natural gas prices have been very range bound over the course of the last few months, and indeed over the last few years. That's, I think, a reflection of the fact that there is just so much additional supply. And around $3, we're in the middle of the $2 to $4 range. And this does not look like a particularly trendy environment. And it would really require a supply shock, but there's unlikely to be a supply shock against a background where shale demand continues to improve. What also that suggests is that there is the only thing that could potentially see these prices rally significantly is if you had a pipeline shutdown. And I think when you think about where all the oil is coming from in Texas, that is the state that is least likely to have a big movement against infrastructure development in terms of pipelines. So it's only a matter of time before the bottleneck in that region and the supply situation that they have eases. If we do in fact get that, then the spread between WTI and Brent could narrow further. So there's certainly a lot going on, and when we think about where are we in the broader cycle, well, I think people are increasingly starting to think about the yield curve spread. I'm seeing new stories about it on almost a daily basis at this stage, because it is now at less than 35 basis points, And considering that it was at a peak of nearly 80 basis points back in February, or back in December, it was closer to 60, then we have had a really significant deterioration over the last few months. And we can also see that with central bank balance sheets starting to contract, that it is natural that monetary conditions would start to tighten up. And then we have the and let me see if I can find this systemic banks of systemic importance index. And when we I did find it earlier. If I can find it tomorrow, I'll post it in comment of the day. But what we've definitely seen is when we look at the outlook for banks generally, then global banks, this I can certainly see that this index hasn't been updated until since 2011, so that's definitely not the right one. Well, this is the one. When we look at global banking sectors, they're deteriorating, and this is, I think, one of the more important points, that it is Chinese banks and European banks that are underperforming so far. If and the and this was the index I was searching for, because it includes all of the systemically important banks. So if we look at the constituents of the index, you've got JP Morgan there, and you've got UFJ and Bank of America and BNP Paribas. But you also have ICBC, Bank of China, and Construction Bank, Agricultural Bank of China, and then you have a number of the UK banks. Well, we know that it is European banks are leading on the downside, along with the Japanese banks. Sorry, along with the Chinese banks. And when we look at some of these individual charts, European banks have very clearly broken the progression of higher reaction lows, and then encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean, and they continue to deteriorate. And this is all against a background where the ECB seems to be intent on ending its quantitative easing program. I think there is a good argument that the European economy is nowhere near ready enough for that. That is something that is an outstanding question. If we look at the FTSE 350 bank index, then what we're presented with is another index that is trading below its trend mean, and it's within the context of a much lengthier range. It's the US banks that have represented relative strength in this cycle, but even the S&P 500 banks index is now right at the region of the lower side of its range. When if we were to then just step back, instead of looking at the big global banks and just look at regional US banks, well, then they have outperformed, but they're also pulling back and unwinding a short-term overbought condition. But the much bigger picture is that banks are liquidity providers, and bull markets thrive on liquidity. Well, we've seen that liquidity is getting more expensive and is being withdrawn from the system. And banks in a significant number of markets are underperforming. Well, in the markets where banks are underperforming most acutely, well, that's where we have to conclude that the epicenter of risk is. What that suggests is that it is China and Europe where you have risk right now, and much less risk in the USA. But that doesn't mean there's no risk in the USA, and that there we are most likely to be in a corrective environment, at least to unwind the short-term overbought conditions that have evolved. And you'll be familiar with my refrain that I think that Netflix and Tesla are the canaries in the coal mine. Well, Netflix was down $26 today. It is trading back below the $400 handle, and it's looking increasingly likely that we're going to get at least a reaction similar to what we had in February, and well, potentially a mean reversion pullback. Whereas Tesla, was relatively unchanged in here today, but it had been pulling back in the early part, or the sorry, the latter part of last week. But so far, it is sustaining this move back above the trend mean, and as long as it can do that, then that's going to, I think, allay the fears of a lot of investors. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.